Joining me today is Kaylin Babcock. He's an educator in Osaka, and we finished off Hashimoto. We could probably say some more about that jerk, but I wanted to get into a very popular topic about Japan, and it's not Fukushima. And we want to talk about the island disputes, primarily the Senkaku Islands, and kind of go over a history of many island disputes that you may or may not be aware of that are not as popular as Senkaku, but nonetheless should be in the news and yet are not. So, Kaylin, I hear that the Japanese are now saying they want to change their textbooks in high schools and junior high schools to say that, what island disputes? There aren't any island disputes. These are all Japanese islands. Your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I don't know what problem this is supposed to solve, because the fact that they are disputed, I would think, would encourage students even more to be, you know, to incent them, to make them, you know, have a sense of passion that they should push back by saying there is no dispute. Strikes me as a ostrich head in the sand kind of tactic.
Well, if there wasn't a dispute, most people wouldn't know they exist, because
they're not even really islands.
We're talking about rocks.
These, you know, your average beautiful South Pacific atoll has a lot more attraction and tourist appeal than what we call the Senkaku Islands. They are not habitable by any means. I mean, you'd be lucky to even have a few seabirds nesting on these things. But it all comes down to starting in the 1970s, when they did geological surveys of the area and said there might be oil and natural gas and mineral under them, their islands. And as a result, at that point, it became an area of dispute, for example, the Senkaku specifically with China. And even before that, we can go back to the end of World War II, when islands previously possessed by Japan were claimed by the quote-unquote victors of World War II, let's say Russia, China, and Korea, the ones that basically said, yeah, we're on the winning side, and just to punish you, we're going to go ahead and just claim these islands at your moment of weakness. So
yeah,
the islands were seized forcibly.
Islands up north.
Yeah, that Russia has the islands up north. Korea took the Takashima Islands. And then, but the Senkaku Islands were actually the exception to the rule up until about 1971. China.
That's because the Americans took those islands and then returned them.
Well, there you go.
And the reason they returned them is they were using Japan as a giant aircraft carrier to attack Korea themselves in the Korean War.
Well, there's nothing like having a functional military with really big guns to really cement your claim on something. So up until about 1971, China itself still marked those islands as belonging to Japan and even marked them as the Senkakus. And when that particular geological survey came out, they recanted. They basically rescinded those maps and said, no, we're going to start marking those with the title of Diaoyu. I'm going to ask people to forgive me for my crappy Chinese pronunciation, but yeah. A whole bunch of vowels in a row. Diaoyu Islands.
And what happened to those maps? Because it seems like, can't we just pull up your old maps and show you on the Chinese maps that these have Japanese names and they weren't in dispute until oil was found under them?
Funny you should ask. Those maps obviously still exist somewhere in an archive for safekeeping. But and we're talking about in public libraries in China. But requesting to see maps predating 1971, you will be promptly told that those maps are restricted and off limits. They didn't say they don't exist. They just say you're not allowed to see them. So, of course, people knew that these maps existed, and they knew about the fact that China had labeled the islands in question as belonging to Japan. So some Western journalists, you know, had the bright idea of asking the original company that had printed the maps if they could have a copy of any given map predating that period. And they said, oh, yeah, sure. Because the private company that made the maps, you know, basically didn't have the government agenda and I guess hadn't been outright forbidden by the government to not say anything about them. So, yeah, those maps now are in the possession of people outside of China who can look at them and say, by golly, there you are, official, you know, proof that China had, you know, basically by just lip service said, yes, these islands are now ours. And if we just label the maps as such, it will make it so.
Just seems like an old Indian treaty. They would give the American Indians some land that was theirs already. And then once gold or something was found on it, oh, wait, we need to move you over here now.
Well, you know, it sounds a lot like The same way when Georgia was bought by the American government, and it was done so because after the Indian tribe official governments had basically said no and go away, there was a small minority of people from that tribe who did not represent the official government came in and said, oh, well, we'd be happy to sell it to you. And the American government was able to say, oh, well, see, these people from this tribe sold us this land. It's now ours.
Yeah, I mean, I'd be happy to sell you Georgia, too, because if you're going to give me a bunch of money, it doesn't matter to me because I don't really own it anyway.
Exactly. It's like, I will sell you something. Yeah, it's like the Brooklyn Bridge. I will sell you a bridge. It's not mine, but I will be happy to take your money. And so, yeah, we're looking at that with as it moves, as it progresses forward into modern times, as in now, it's not just a matter of the mineral rights, for example, which is important, the shipping lanes, as we've talked to before and you brought up. It's the shipping lanes, it's the mineral rights, the new ADIZ, their defensive perimeter, which is merely yet another way to flex their muscles. We're talking about China specifically, flexing their muscles and saying, you know, this is ours by dint of if you fly into it, we may shoot you down.
Well, it's a concrete thing to point to that the public can swallow and understand.
Right.
Which justifies more saber rattling and military spending on all sides.
Right. I mean,
it's a billion-dollar wedge issue, you know.
Right. Well, the problem is that the Chinese government shot themselves in the foot when they kind of let their original communist principles slide into this quasi free market capitalism model they have now, which isn't so much capitalism as it is kind of a controlled anarchist slide into, let's just see if we can let things grow as fast as they can.
Well, China has the worst of both worlds. They have zero regulations on labor or the environment or anything like that.
And zero public voice.
Yet the state completely picks all the winners and losers in the marketplace and subsidizes everything. So they have the worst of communism.
They have America's, the basically America's worst nightmare. Like, this is where things could go. So the thing is that when we had the Tiananmen Square massacre, that was the turning point when the Chinese government realized if we don't do something, people are obviously starting to lose faith in our political system. And without that faith, it's hard to make them swallow the notion that the solitary communist party has the right to rule. So, as with any good, you know, vested interest, they said, well, you know, it's not that we're at fault. The real problem is those invisible guys over there across the water. Yeah, we all hate them. It's always the, you know who we really hate? The guy not in the room. Let's talk about him right now, you know.
Yeah, blame the foreigners. But I'll tell you something that the right-wing Japanese are doing, which muddies the waters, pun intended, is that, okay, let's say Senkaku is Japanese and always has been. That's been verified on maps from all around the world and so on.
Right.
Yet when Abe and Hashimoto and these losers get up and say these ridiculous things about comfort women or denying the Nanking massacre and things like that, then they also say something about the islands. People go, well, we already know they're a bunch of racist, xenophobic idiots, and they are also pro-Japan islands, so they must be wrong on that too, because they're clearly wrong on these other things. And so when those weirdos go and say that, you kind of get grouped in with them. I mean, it's kind of like if Hitler said the sky is blue, it doesn't mean it's not. It's still blue, even if a bad person says it, you know. And so they might say something that's true, but it's grouped in with a bunch of other things that are absolute nonsense and totally racist.
It's the baby. It's the baby in the bathwater.
Baby in the bathwater, right?
Yeah. So the problem is that while Prime Minister Abe and his cabinet and his yes men are a serious problem for Japan right now. Oh, such a serious problem. They're not wrong on this.
The president of NHK made a stupid military brothel.
Jeez, yeah. And actually, I posted this on Twitter just today that the last couple of months have shown that the people currently under Abe's regime have struck upon a rather, original idea for getting around the problem of a politician or a public official speaking out and saying something negative in public. They say, I'm going to say that Comfort Women are perfectly okay, but that's just my personal opinion. As if somehow this...
it's freedom of speech again.
It's the freedom of speech problem, exactly, with Hashimoto.
Right,
it's
you're
like,
free to say that, and we're free to say it's stupid.
I respect the fact. It is a fact of human existence, of human nature, that we all have private opinions that may not really be that well received by, you know, the general population. But the point is that when you accept the job, you accept the responsibility that you can't just blab on about every last neurotic, you know, extremist
figure.
Notion. It's like almost like, you know, I don't know, like say the Tea Party. You can't just go off on every little neurotic notion that you have and somehow think that it's okay if you whitewash it by saying, but it's just my personal opinion. I know it's your personal opinion.
Obama's not a secret Muslim born in Kenya.
Yeah, there you go. It's like, I know it's your personal opinion. That's why I don't like you. That's why I don't think you should have your job. It doesn't make it better. So anyway, but
they don't apologize for it. And now they go, "Oh, that's what
which
I
is,
think."
Which is worrisome. The thing is that honestly, again, never ascribe to enemy action what you can ascribe to pure stupidity. I mean, these guys, they're worrisome not because they're diabolical, but because I think that they are, you know, they're naive fools with way too much power in their hands. And the thing is that we need to be aware, the people of the world need to be aware of, Japan's current political climate is not something that we should say, aha, this is Japan, just merely rediscovering its imperialist roots. No, this is the symptom of being bullied and badgered by South Korea and by China incessantly over the perceived wrongs done to them that now are, you know, what, 70 years old?
Yeah, it's kind of the how many times do you want me to say sorry thing.
Yeah, it's like when people sit there and say, your ancestors, you know, used my ancestors as slaves. You should totally feel sorry for me. It's like, neither of us was alive when that happened. So
yeah,
we both woke up and
the wrongness.
Those were wrongs, but I mean, we, you know, how far back do you have to go? There needs to be a statute of limitations. So the point is that China, South Korea, you know, their politicians aren't perfect either. They're doing things that make the people mad, and their simple solution is to say, but you know what? As long as we have Japan there to hate, we're okay.
Yeah,
so
it's a scapegoat, and it distracts from other economic problems and issues in South Korea and China. President Park and President Lee both, well, it was Lee first and then Park in South Korea, and President Hu and President Xi Jinping in China, got plenty of problems on their own, and they are, especially in South Korea, extremely far right-wing kind of lunatics. And Abe and these guys in Japan, I'd like to point out, as bad as their personal opinions are, when they did try to change the textbooks to downplay wartime sex slavery, which they call Comfort Women, all 47 prefectures in Japan rejected the books.
But yeah.
What Abe's done is he tried to pull something Bush and Obama both did and are good at is, okay, so none of the boards of education are going to choose these extremely right-wing books. So we'll try and change the system and allow the mayor to choose the books instead of the education ministry or the BOE.
And that originally started in Okinawa, where what they'd actually preemptively, I think due to a little bit of
Can you imagine if Hashimoto got to choose the textbooks in Osaka?
Oh, sweet baby Jesus, no. I think good old-fashioned nepotism in Okinawa resulted in the original task of having the Board of Education determine the curriculum and textbooks for the year was turned over to a single individual who basically decided to go nuts, and he went with his own particular revisionist agenda. And there is currently a lawsuit on the part of the government because basically the teachers just said, we're not going to teach this. Screw you. No, this is not how it's done. This is completely, this person who's making the decision on these textbooks has absolutely no knowledge, is obviously revisionist and trying, has an agenda of his own, and they turned it down outright.
Anti-revision if it's factual, but this is not.
It's one thing to say, you know what, we need to go back and fix some stuff that was obviously trying to gloss over things from the past. But no, this is like saying, for example, the real simple one when they say, well, no, these islands aren't under dispute. Well, yes, they are. It's a simple fact. Nowadays, they're adding the thing is in Japan, there's a printed manual of the do's and do nots, what teachers can teach. And they just added to the list that teachers are not allowed to really talk about nuclear power. I mean, not just can't talk about the problems in Fukushima, but you can't even touch hot button topics to educate kids that, for example, there might be safe alternatives to nuclear power.
Yeah, and nuclear power is something you'd have to teach in history and science classes anyway. It's a very modern, you know, needed thing to know, a needed topic.
If I teach a kid that thorium is a safe alternative to nuclear power, how is that a political agenda? It's a fact of physics. It's science. It's like saying
coal has more pollution than
we've stopped using steam-powered engines and we've now switched to diesel. How is that a political agenda?
Oh, you're just anti-burning logs, man, and coal.
I know, right? Well, if I didn't hate water so much. But the thing is that, and you can get back to...
Do you think that's because of the threat of the monster parents and stuff? They go, oh, don't say anything about nuclear because, you know...
I think there's a kind of a catch-22. There's a certain cyclical problem in Japan where it actually originates with, let's say, the government and the Department of Education, which influences the universities. And they are the ones that, for example, set the standard for the publicly, actually globally acknowledged, ridiculously difficult entrance exams. Mm-hmm. And of course, what do you say to the parents? Well, if your kid's smart enough to get into these universities, he'll pass the exam. So of course the parents want the hard tests, which means they now put the pressure on the teachers. You've got to teach them to pass these super hard tests. And when they say to the universities, maybe these tests are too hard, well, which university is going to lower their standards first and admit that they aren't as good as the other ones? So again, same problem happens with the issue of hot button topics, where it's like, okay, you know, Japan is kind of on a tipping point where they're starting to recognize that they can not be so self-loathing anymore. They're kind of slow to the game. I mean, Japanese people are very sincere people, and they're kind of slow to realize, you know, maybe we can like being Japanese while accepting that we had stuff in the past that we're, you know, kind of ashamed of. And that's okay. You know, that's the way life works. There's always going to be that bit of that, you know, give and take, that dark and light. So then you've got the government saying, we got this new secrecy law, which very conveniently allows us to basically dictate what is and what isn't a public, a necessary secret.
Well, the main thing they're hiding there is not Fukushima, it's TPP.
Right. Yeah. That was the United States Trade Representative, or the Office of the United States Trade Representative, the USTR, said Japanese diplomats, apparently, this actually surprised me to find this out, are notoriously bad at keeping secrets. And, you know, living in Japan, where people like to, you know, they pride themselves on their ability not to bring things up. It's like, really? That's a thing? Okay. So there was pressure from the United States saying, you guys really need to do something about that. And they presented the secrecy law under the guise of course, let's stop terrorism. It's all about saving the kids and stopping terrorism and, you know, standing up for the American dream, or sorry, Japanese dream.
The Patriot Act got pushed through as.
Yeah, exactly. So the point is,
they even named it the Patriot Act. If you vote against that, you're unpatriotic.
There you go. So actually, I recently was explaining to a friend of mine, a Japanese person who speaks fluent English, that
I want to make a law and just name it the Love Little Babies Act. Because who's going to
I like
that down?
Exactly. You know, this is the perfect pork barrel opportunity. Just roll everything in there. It's like a big old roll of bacon right there. So the thing is that I explained to my Japanese friend there's a difference between patriotism and nationalism. And it was a long time before I became aware of this, even as a kid back in the United States growing up, you know, and taking United States history, for example, where we were taught that Americans are patriotic and other countries are nationalistic, which occasionally leads to problems. And they often cited, you know, France as a good example, going through five different governments and they're all very nationalistic, et cetera, et cetera. And I realized, wait. How are the two different? Nationalist versus patriot. And the difference is merely trying to create this negative connotation that somehow
questions his government.
No, a patriot loves his country, and then a nationalist worships his nation as if somehow that's a different thing. You know, it's, so the point is that again, we now are seeing this reactionary government in Japan. China and South Korea are merely lending fuel to the fire. Because right now the Japanese feel very defensive and put upon. And I think any country in the same situation, especially when they're being menaced by this far superior as far as a military and, you know, now economically superior neighbor, they're going to feel threatened.
Much larger anyway.
And larger in any case.
Sankaku has been part of Japan longer than Hawaii has been part of the United States or Alaska.
And they have better claim to Hawaii. Like turning said, Texas congratulations, you're American. Versus,
I'm not saying I agree with how those territories were acquired.
Oh no, it's fine.
There's no way they're going back. Like, it's just not politically feasible. But they're going to act like that anyway because they want to saber rattle and up their arms budgets. And this is a real thing. I mean, they've sent the Ospreys and the F-22s and 35s and stuff that doesn't work to Okinawa and also to South Korea, and then China has also built up its own on its other side by pointing at the Americans. And a problem I see is a lot of people who are against American imperialism, because it's obvious that it is an imperial country. They're all over the Middle East, Africa, they're butchering people, they kill people with drones, they start wars. They automatically are kind of siding with China. They have this sort of China file, Russia file mentality.
Enemy of my enemy is my friend.
Yeah, because they're against America. But what they don't understand is it's not good versus bad. It's bad versus bad.
No, the enemy of my enemy is also an enemy. Is a possible thing. It's like,
exactly.
You know.
What if they're just your enemy too? What if it's just another imperial power? China invaded Burma. China's, you know, people work in China with suicide nets on their factories where they live in a dormitory at their factory for $2 a day with limited water. And it's a communist country on paper. It's just fascism everywhere. It's from top to bottom. The wealth disparity in China is a lot worse than most places. And these poor people,
there's
200 million Chinese people living on $2 a day.
But the government through its non-intervention is throwing its own people under the bus. And considering all of the there are a huge number of disparate cultures that are wrapped up into the nation that is China. So some of these people being thrown under the bus is kind of like saying, well, I don't really care about them because, you know, they're not really my people. Mm-hmm. And
also you have Tibet in the middle of that. Also.
Exactly. And, you know, China, that's the thing that people should keep in mind. China should, in one way, be appreciated because they have a 5,000-year history. And by that token, they've had 5,000 years of practice of being a real dick. You know, this is, I had a friend of mine who was saying, you know, we should try to be open-minded about the China versus Japan dispute. And I replied, no, there really isn't a lot of open-mindedness in this. You know, as far as China's ability to have a good economy or bad economy, when you got a 5,000-year history, it's not so much a matter of effort. It's more like trying to control the tides. It's just going to – it goes in waves, and it's going to go in waves because
– China's a bully. And I'm they've not been impressed around, yeah, with their yeah. economic achievements because it's pretty easy to manufacture stuff when you have slaves.
Well, no, that's the thing. And the other thing is that China – they're currently burning their own internal human resources in a way that is like self-cannibalization. And the problem is, it's like in many of these very proactive, forward-facing structures, and this even you can even say, for example, going back to the Roman Empire, the reason the Roman Empire failed was when it ran out of fuel. And by fuel, I mean it was a outward-facing military culture that ran up to the point where they no longer had anybody to conquer. And they simply collapsed because they ran out of fuel. And China's going to run into the same problem. They are allowing things to balloon out of control. You've got the huge, wonderfully, you know, modern, beautiful city developments in China that are currently unoccupied because they're allowing unregulated, uncontrolled, wild speculation, both domestically and from foreign interests, that make those, for example, modern housing developments impossible to own, impossible to rent, impossible to live in. Because
they have ghost cities.
Yeah, ghost cities.
Simultaneously with all these homeless people, and they can't let the price drop down because then the speculators would lose money in their investment.
And actually, you probably know this better than me.
The government is intervening because the government is using its own state money to prop up the price of all that property, which the market would naturally devalue dramatically so that people could move in.
Yeah, you're talking about people earning $2 a day and apartments worth, say, in the United States dollars, $120,000 to own. And by American standards, $120,000 will buy you a decent, you know, well-outfitted home. But
in China, there's no property tax.
On $2 a day, where are you going to start?
Buying as much as they want and not paying property taxes. And that's how you get monopolies a lot faster.
Land and again, the speculation, this all comes back down to the same problem, which is you've got people making money off of speculation, but they're not expecting any kind of reasonable development to come out of it. So they're in it for the quick burn. And in Japan, we're experiencing the same problem where the prime minister is attempting to, you know, fix the economy, to reignite the economy using his so-called Abenomics, which wiser heads than I have called Ahonomics. Aho is the Japanese word for idiot or stupid.
It's a mild word for it.
Very mild word for it. Yeah, it could get worse. But the point is that as a result of Abenomics, a lot of the people are saying, I'm still not seeing a lot of gain for myself. I'm seeing that imports have increased by 25% is in my personal cost. I'm seeing that commodity prices are going up. I'm seeing that sales tax is increasing by 3% as of April, 8% by the end of the year, and eventually probably targeted to 16%.
And the yen fell 25 cents to the dollar.
Yeah, so
a lot of inflation.
That's where the import price increase comes from. So, and the justification for the sales tax comes from the idea that the government will use that to bridge the gap in their huge deficit hole. The problem is half of the money from the sales tax is going to go to local governments, and as in there's a division between the local and the national level in terms of how sales tax is distributed. It seems reasonable. The problem is that the final tally for the national sales tax, as far as how much the government takes in, is a fraction of what they need to actually pay off the deficit. So,
and yet it hurts the common person. It's just
so
buy
there's
less
absolutely
stuff.
Basically, you might as well not raise the sales tax at all because it's not fixing anything. It's merely making it worse. And this
plus the total revenue doesn't always go up. I mean, like what Reagan and John Kennedy showed, they lowered taxes and got a larger tax revenue because it's better half a loaf of bread than none, sort of thing. And what people do is if the taxes are too high, they just don't go out to eat as much, they don't go shopping as much, and they don't buy anything at all. And
well, that's the Schadenfreude aspect of this, is that they're saying Abe has said, and this is the linchpin in his plan, is that he wants to, quote-unquote, encourage companies to voluntarily raise wages. But the companies themselves, now the large corporations are making out like bandits, as they always do. The small companies, the ones that really need the economy to improve, because we're talking, as of today, a full 40% of the Japanese workforce is now part-time or temporary employed.
That's amazing.
That's just a mind-boggling figure. I mean, you want to talk about... Then Japan actually coined the English phrase, the working poor. That's actually the name for it in Japan as well as, in English. They have discovered the companies can't raise the wages because they've gutted their consumer market. I actually said this even 8 years ago when the working poor phrase first really came to the forefront as a current issue, was these companies don't realize that when they're not paying their employees, they're also not paying their consumers.
Yep. And down the road, it hurts them because you just got rid of your own purchasers.
Yeah.
Which is something Henry Ford figured out. If I pay my employees enough to buy the cars they're making, they'll buy the cars they're making.
You know, at the very least, they could go back to the old-fashioned concept of the company store. That might be, a small you know, carrot thrown to the poor people who are sitting there working these horrible jobs. At least
that's
they would
the
have
thing that they always to try to trickle down and fix things from the top. And if we fix these big companies first, no, you have to fix the bottom. If you increase the money supply so that consumers can spend more, businesses will have better business because that's all of their customers.
You know, maybe it sounds naive, but the idea of trickle-down economics, let me put it this way. It's like I'm a guy earning, by unofficial standards, just above the poverty level of Japan, by unofficial standards, of course. So I can live decently, and I can actually, at the same salary in America, I would be really, really poor. So fair enough. I mean, there are good things about Japan. But the thing is that, you know what? If I had the option, I wouldn't pay my rent. I wouldn't pay as much for groceries. You can look at that as an allegory to trickle-down economics. Nobody wants to pay more if they can get away with it. Why on earth would a rich person want to give more money to a poor person if they don't have to?
Yeah, even if they can pocket some savings, why do you have to pass it on to someone when you can keep it?
Yeah, I mean, who wants to? Because, you know, it's really, again, it's human nature. It's like the idea of being able to, you know, squirrel away nuts for the winter. There's always going to be a rainy day. It's built into our nature. But the thing is that when you evolve beyond the mere biological and you start thinking about, and hey, you could even say, it's not even a romantic notion. It's almost a Machiavellian notion. The idea of, if I take care of my neighbor, they're not going to come murdering me in the night for my gold.
Right.
So, I mean, there really is a kind of a culture evolution necessary. And again, we've gone way, way, way off topic at this point, but it comes back to China and their attempts now to muscle into the South China Sea.
That's the thing, though. I mean, we have all these economic problems and problems in the schools and things, and yet all they ever talk about in the papers are these rocks out in the water.
And China's doing the same thing. And again, it's part of their burning their own people as fuel kind of mentality. They're like, we're going to shortly run out of easily acquirable fuel for the fire in terms of economics. And so they're saying, oh, okay, what's the next step? It's just like when you create money by loaning out more money than actually exists. They're saying, well, rather than trying to internalize the problem and solve it, let's merely grab for the nearest available resource that we can simply just add to our collective and thereby enrich ourselves and basically kick the can down the road. And again, the thing is that a military economy is always a growing economy.
Well, it's the U.S. equivalent of when you have a political problem and you don't know what to do, blame the Mexicans.
the beauty of it is that the majority of the world is brown people. So, hey, there's lots of blame to pass around. So now we've got basically China, and it isn't just China versus Japan. It isn't just South Korea versus Japan. We should flip this around. It really is China versus most of Southeast Asia. There are currently nine
Bradley
countries.
Island
disputes. Yeah, that's right. There are nine countries in dispute with China. And actually the biggest opponent in that dispute is actually Vietnam. And the second one after that would be the Philippines. I mean, Japan's really kind of getting off easy. And maybe a little bit is due to the fact that they really honestly don't lay claim to that much outside of, you know, what they already have traditionally owned for, you know, again, centuries and centuries. But also, China has realized that, again, not just realized, maybe they have this desire for a little bit of imperialism and expansion. And they realize that if they own the South China Sea, they own really what is the last economic frontier on the planet. I mean, the South China Sea is still very much up in the air. It's a very much a Wild West kind of scenario. A lot of important shipping lanes go through there. There's obviously unexplored potential in petroleum and other...
Well, it's the water version of Central Asia.
Yeah, exactly. And then they also want to be able to go in there and harvest, you know, even more mundane things like a lot of the seafood and other wildlife in the area. there, the Spratly Islands. There's a wonderful article that
one of the seven great choking points.
And yeah, you, exactly.
You see, and like, you have the Panama Canal and the Suez Canal and the Strait of Hormuz, etc., the Port of Aden and Spratly.
It's an artery, and if you control that, if you can cut it, you can really wound a lot of people.
Yeah, you're the ultimate middleman on all the ships passing in and out. And
which is why the new ADIZ is covering conveniently that entire area. And this is the weird kind of incestuous relationship, for obvious reasons, that China has with Taiwan. That they are now, even Taiwan is kind of like saying, well, we lay claim to this area too, and although we're still not officially part of China, China is like going, yeah, we're cool with Taiwan claiming that. So it literally just doubles their negotiation power because they're letting Taiwan, you know, take responsibility for certain sections, which they implicitly cooperate to, you know, cohabitate, basically.
Mm-hmm. It's just using it as leverage for another issue.
Exactly. And it should be mentioned that China's very bizarre tactic in all of this, in which they have announced as they will very smugly admit as an official strategy with them is what they call the cabbage strategy. And what they'll do is they'll go to, for example, island by island. We're talking about the Spratlys here, for example. They'll go island by island with...
Which are not even remotely close to China.
Not at all. Look on the map. Again, I passed along that great article to you from the New York Times Magazine, which I really encourage people to watch.
I hate the New York Times, but this was a great article.
It's well done. It's beautiful. It's interactive. It has a very graphic map that clearly lays out the different occupational areas, the different economic zones, and so on. It's obvious that the Spratly Islands should be co-owned, if by anybody, by Indonesia and the Philippines, by proximity, if nothing else. Again,
I can see all those claims, and even Vietnam, but China, that's ridiculous.
And Vietnam, I agree.
Might as well just have India claim them. I mean,
yeah, exactly. Or the United States, because, you know, hey, we've done it before.
They're just as close to Hawaii as.
Yeah, exactly. But I mean, exactly. So the thing is that, if you look on the map, if you subtract the China colored regions from the area, it's obvious that there's a pretty reasonable balance between Malaysia, Vietnam, and the Philippines. And then you got these Johnny come latelys that are smack dab in the middle of the islands. That are China and Taiwan, and but looking at the color coding, it's obvious that these claims are very haphazard, and their concept is, again, comes back to this cabbage strategy. They simply claim it, and they sit on it, and if anybody else comes on, they will threaten them. They won't fire on them or anything like that, but they simply, you know, just sail up close to them.
Yeah, they send big warships down there.
That's right, and they basically just make them leave. And what they do is they call it the cabbage because they build layer upon layer outward, saying we win by the rule that possession is 9/10 of the law.
It's like Israeli settlers. Starts with a road, and then a tent, and then a house.
Yeah, once you're there, you're there, man. What are you going to do? It's like it's the bully on the playground who just kind of bumps you and says, hey, what, man? I'm just standing here, right? Bump, 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 until you leave. And he's like, that guy left. And that's basically China's strategy. They're really pushing the borders of how far you can take this without it becoming a military issue. To be quite honest, I don't think at this point or even in the next few years that this would turn into a physical military issue between, say, Japan and China, for example. But I do think that the United States government, in one of the few times when I am actually on their side when it comes to proactive military presence.
Well, they're just doing the right thing for the wrong
reason.
They're
doing what, the reason?
They're not governed by right and wrong. They're governed by what will make the most profits for us today.
But as an American, I have to say, if I was going to buy into the reason for an American military presence, this is a good one. This is worthy of Americans saying, this is exactly when America, you know, taking on its self-imposed mantle of the, you know, policeman of the world, cop of the world. This is one of those few times where it's justified because these are small countries that are
the same as Russia supporting Syria.
Yeah, these are small countries minding their own business who basically would carry on just fine if it wasn't for basically, you know, dicks like China coming in and saying, that's fine too. And this is a case where it's not bad for another power equal to China to come in and say, I don't think so. But the problem is, of course, is that, you know.
However, if China wasn't there, the U.S. would beat China.
Well, fair enough. I mean, you know, and we invented the idea of economic imperialism, right? And it has been said before. What's that?
I mean, the British, I think, did the best.
Fair enough. Yeah. I mean, the British, they also had the direct straight up military imperialism as well. But mm-hmm. the United States, of course, we've had our military incursions. We obviously annexed Hawaii. We possessed Guam. We had the Philippines for a long time. But by and large, I want to give the United States the benefit of the doubt in saying that the corporate issues aside, as far as what, you know, the public will buy into, this is one of those few times where it's not just a matter of showing muscle, but, you know, actually doing a decent thing. And of course, obviously, this can all be eventually subverted, probably will be subverted. And maybe it's a good thing that in this case, it is against China, because you've got that detente, you've got that balance of power that hopefully will keep the two bullies at bay. But I pity, you know, Indonesia and Philippines and Vietnam for being stuck in the middle, because
tug of war.
I don't know. I'm hoping it's not going to make their lives, you know, too much more miserable having these two big bullies basically saying to the Philippines, for example, maybe the United States will say, hey, you know, what if we started doing bases where you are again, for example?
And yeah, it could be a selling point. And some of my more sinister thoughts are saying, maybe China and the U.S. are doing this together.
No, I think it's too sinister. No, I really think in this case, I mean, I definitely think that China is, you know, China and the United States is like Sherlock Holmes and Moriarty. And I'll leave it up to you to decide which one's which. But the point is that they are a very diabolical combination. They're more fascinated with opposing each other, and everybody else in between is just collateral damage. So the most I would worry about is, I don't think that there's going to be a lot of loss in human lives at this point, but I do think it's going to really create a problem economically for the region, because it's going to become very regimented into black and white, China versus the United States, for example.
Well, I wasn't saying like working together as in both sitting down at a table and saying, look, we'll screw the little guy, but as in doing acts that have a very predictable outcome on there. If we act like this, then they're going to get more militant too. And I think the U.S. sort of goads people into arms races intentionally.
Well, exactly.
Tries to prolong them as long as possible, when they could probably dominate in most cases. Listen, now we'll just, whatever they do, we're going to even it.
But the problem is that you have to keep an ever-present enemy to fuel the military-industrial complex.
Yeah.
You've got...
Terrorists in China. Those are the two.
Yeah. If you end up... Yeah, cyber. Yes, that's the new one, right? The beauty of it is that in this modern age, they've distilled the formula down to these terms, not just countries, but terms. Terrorists and cyber warfare.
A war on a tactic.
Exactly. A war on the boogeyman. And the best part about it is that
the original boogeymen were from Indonesia, by the way.
Oh, there you go. All right. It's appropriate.
That story actually came from boogeymen.
And Indonesia's going, well, crap. Came back to bite us in the butt. So anyway, the point is that you've got America in the current environment where you've got to feed the corporate belly. It's in their best interest to continue having this ambiguous, amorphous enemy that can never be completely defeated. It fuels the narrative.
Drugs to that too.
Well, sure, yeah. But it fuels the narrative. It just keeps things going. Yeah, war on drugs. Yeah, exactly. As long as you can keep it, we're fighting crime, we're fighting drugs, we're fighting terror, we're fighting emotions. Yay! You know, we're fighting, you know, all of these, you know, the internet. Woo, that's a new thing. You know, I'm on the internet. I use Facebook. We should be fighting Facebook now. So the thing is that as long as you keep they've perfected the notion of the Hydra, the snake with 100 heads. You cut one off and two grow back. And the best part is they don't even have to bother going out and finding.
I'm biting my lip not to quote Captain America.
Well, go ahead. It's up to you, man. But
cut one off, two more will take its place.
There you go. So the problem is that I say the problem for us, the people, the citizens who are, you know, trying to live our lives and hopefully, you know, just, you know, keep our heads above water, is that we've got governments who have boiled it down to this perfect formula where it's become a science, where they can merely just aggravate the situation by inserting, like I said, they don't even have to bother looking for a new country anymore, but just basically you've got your bad guy of the week. And it just, at this point, there's no solution in sight.
And terrorism replaced communism in that regard.
Yeah, if we don't stop fighting terrorism.
Red, they knew damn well that there was no threat of communism or anything, and they just went around attacking Central American countries and justify it by saying, commie.
Isn't it fun that we don't even, like, it's like, somehow, like, picking a color to fight wasn't good enough anymore. That's like, screw colors. Like, let's fight the rainbow. Actually, that's another story, but yeah.
Well, that, you know, it's like the red state fascism and stuff. And then we get a blue team and they act the exact same way as the red team did. And yet.
But our team is better. Because it's our team.
Well, yeah, our team's our color. And it's in our area. It's in the north or whatever. that's how the, you know, the level of political discourse is down to that of, like, sports teams and mascots and stuff.
Yeah, we owe it to ourselves if we want to have a world that just isn't going to be managed by a handful of people. We owe it to ourselves to realize that there is no perfect solution, and that's okay. The balance of power, the struggling of forces, is really what keeps things on an even keel. And aiming for one utopia or dystopia or another isn't going to solve anything. You know, we really, you know, it's all about being able to say, I hear your opinion, you hear my opinion, and we make a compromise. And if nobody's completely happy, that's a sign that things are working. But when everybody's unhappy, when the majority's unhappy, as we are now, you know, blaming it on the brown people, the yellow people, or whatever, is not solving anything. It's merely just putting the problem somewhere else.
What a tired and old excuse, too.
Yeah, it's like really think we'd outgrow that, too, yeah.
You'd think so. But that's how it is. And, you know, the hypocrisy, too, of looking at the textbooks in Korea and China and how they're already censored and always have been.
Yeah, they don't bother hiding it. They're like going, what? Japan sucks.
It doesn't justify Japan doing it. It's just spread the blame around, and it's a little hypocritical.
It's the pot calling the kettle black.
For China to be saying what Japan did during World War II when China is currently doing that to its own people. They have massive sex slave industry right now. And Japan has a slave industry too, a sex slave industry, but compared to China, it's like, it's nothing.
I mean, they're not trying. Well, I mean, hey, Japan.
And in the China
has
World War II,
China
too.
Has
I mean,
geography,
Japan,
you know,
killed 300,000 people in Nanking, or possibly more, but China killed 30 million.
Right. You know, I think it's funny because that was the dispute with the updated textbooks, was they're trying to say the Nanking massacre didn't happen. And the weird thing was, is that they admit we probably killed between 2,000 to 40,000 people. Doesn't count as a massacre. It's like, but you admit killing more than, say, I don't know, 2,000, which to me is a lot, but it's not a massacre.
Yeah, it's okay. Splitting hairs. With the
How many people does it have to be? You killed a lot of people. That was a dick move. It's not cool.
Well, and all the rape too. And
yeah, I mean, yeah.
But
matter
again,
of fact,
it's not like other countries didn't rape and murder during World War II.
Which, you know, it's ironic because the
through their textbooks, you don't hear about Eisenhower's death camps in American history textbooks. You don't hear about the oil embargo, or the McCollum memo, which is what brought on Pearl Harbor. Prior to Pearl Harbor, it wasn't like America was twiddling its thumbs. And
well, I mean, how many years of historically, in an unbroken line even, how many decades has America had concentration camps in one form or another? We had the Japanese Americans in World War II.
You
Now we've got Guantanamo Bay.
In World War One.
There you go. Now we've got Guantanamo Bay. Okay, so maybe it's not a, maybe it's a, it is a broken line, but man, you know, even today, you know, we're talking about
human testing in the 70s on African Americans and American Indians.
Doesn't count. They weren't in a camp.
Well, they died. I mean,
but they're dead now. So, hey. So the, but my point just being is that, you know, we talk about the there is no such thing as the American dream so long as we feel the need to marginalize and even, you know, imprison one minority or another for whatever reason.
I'd like to get rid of collectivism in general. Like, just the whole concept of minority and majority. I know people are like proud to be their people or whatever, but I think that's already building walls when you feel this biological attachment to a group.
I agree.
When it supersedes, the humanity ought to be first. And then as a less important thing of that, like you can get into your cultural pride and ethnic pride and things like that. But that ought to be second or tertiary compared to, that we're all people. And it seems to be upside down.
Yeah, I agree. On a biological level, we always feel safe with our tribe, with our family. That's just the way it is. But
well, any group, like with the blacks, with the lesbians,
why does it have to be exclusionary? That's the question.
That's weird to me.
Yeah, I agree. And I mean, I am very comfortable with saying that I believe in the American dream, but that's not the same thing as saying that I agree with the American reality. I think the American dream per se is a really good one. I'm not saying we've achieved it, and I'm not saying that we should ever settle for what we have and say we've achieved it. That's just not a thing. It's a utopia. It's a goal. It's a place to aim for, but it should not be exclusionary. That has certainly not been the history of America. America's always been, I'm sounding very patriotic, but it's always been about the idea of bringing people together, regardless of wealth or stature or so on, you know. And I believe that that should become, you know, the human dream. And, you know, if people are more comfortable with stripping the label America off of it, I'm fine with that. The point is that a couple of people had a really good idea, and I think it's worth sticking with.
Yeah, but not to be, I like you that I'll support the American dream. That doesn't mean I believe that's the American reality. And that's what people have to see. You can strive for something, but that doesn't mean you can't criticize America or the American government. In fact, without criticism, you can never improve.
I always tell people, it's like, if I didn't criticize, I wouldn't be American, because that is the principle my country was founded on.
Yeah, Jefferson said we probably need a revolution every 7 years or so.
And the great George Carlin said, you know, I've never seen any major political change in history that didn't involve bloodshed. And I certainly hope that that is something that we can change.
Hey, they legalized pot in Colorado and Washington.
Well, obviously.
Not really a great political change.
Well, see, you know, obviously people are starting to be rational. Yay. Yeah. So, you know, I mean, let's stop picking on people let's stop creating laws that say, I just want to stop that guy from doing what he's doing.
Yeah, it's not for me. It's to help someone else.
Exactly. And for the children and the babies.
Oh, of course. And the children and the babies and free speech. But yeah, the worst thing about that is I think that marijuana is harmful for them. So let's put them in a cage. That can't harm them at all.
Yeah, exactly. But then that's a story for another day. You know,
some men in costumes to come bang on their shiny pieces of metal and put this person in a cage, because that's much better for them.
Because if you stop this person from sticking grass in his mouth, that will make the world better.
Yeah, I mean, geez, he's got a plant. I mean, it's very dangerous.
You know what I saw him do? I saw him get the munchies.
He was eating like 2 bags of Doritos.
Oh my God, wow. I mean, I normally eat 3, but dude.
He probably chafed in that beanbag too. I mean, we better put him in a cage.
There you go.
For his own good or her own.
All right.
Good. Yeah, sounds good. All right, well, thank you very much for coming on again. And we'll do these little routine Japan updates, I think, quite frequently now.
All right, man. I look forward to it.
Excellent.
Cool.